Station number 15433.
Peter McAleese, side 16, right.
What I remember most about that 2.5 years was, I mean, the South Africans are very liberal with drugs and pain. You know, if you get pain, they'll give you analgesics. You know, and I went through the full spectrum, you know, sort of morphine, Omnipom, Pethidine, Sossigan, you know, and then down onto tablets. And then I was still in pain, given to the old manhood thing. And, you know, I was drinking fairly heavy, you know, and the guys would always come to see me. And it was a heavy South African scene there. Every time somebody came in, they'd have to have a case of beer with them, you know. And what I remember about that time is the depression. You know, I was awful, awful depressed. And, you know, because, you know, I've always been the type of person, I need to get my teeth into things.
Yeah.
I just couldn't get it, you know. And, but what it made me do is when I got back to work, it made me change my management style. And that, you know, I had to bring people in and delegate a bit more. You know, and as I say, whereas I always managed by walking around, you know, and being on the spot at the time. So I had to do that. But it was depressing.
Yeah.
Aye.
So what did you do when you eventually have you had all the plates removed, or how did that work?
No, everything's out now, you know.
Right.
But I finished up with one leg shorter than the other, which is when I'm tired, you can see a pronounced limp, you know.
Right.
This is the shorter one.
Yeah, right. Aye. The left leg. Do you have a prop inside the shoe for that or not?
No. What I do is I sometimes, depending on what shoes I've got on, you know, I've got a little elevator that goes inside the shoe.
Right.
But, you know, it doesn't, with a shoe, you're not comfortable with it, whereas I normally do it inside desert boots or something, you know.
All right. Okay.
And
So how did the company treat you when you were sick? Was it on their behalf? Were you covered by the army?
No, it wasn't. If I'd have been hurt coming out of an army airplane, it would have been a brand new ball game.
Yeah.
You see that? And it was all to do with the medical system out there, you know, paying for things. And
So who paid for all that?
Well, what happened was I was on an 80-20 medical system. Well,
you pay for 20%.
20%. Yeah. Well, you know, when you're going for a prescription, it's not much. But when you're getting operated on, and, you know, it's something like £1,800 a time to hire the theatre. It soon builds up. And as I say, I didn't feel I was doing my job the way I wanted to do it. And the boss of the company, in actual fact, was okay. I probably had trouble with his wife, or, you know, the woman he was living with at that time. But I think a lot of that, in hindsight now, a lot of that could have been to do with me, because I didn't feel myself.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas before, I could walk in and say, I'm sorry, I don't agree with this. And for the following reasons, I felt that I couldn't perform the way I wanted to. So I'm prepared to accept that. I think that, you know, the fact that his wife, at the time, I thought, she's having a buzz at me, you know. You know, in hindsight, it could have been a bit different.
So you had, despite your limbering up for a company promotional parachute job, you wound up paying for it yourself. So you eventually decided to leave South Africa and come back to the UK.
Yeah.
So how did you decide that?
Well, I'll tell you what happened. I was always the type of person, I was totally dedicated to the job I was doing. And Jane got pregnant, you know, just after, you know, I came out of hospital.
Does your wife come from UK originally, or is she from...
No, she's from the UK, yeah.
Oh, yeah. And she was in Rhodesia. How long had she been in Rhodesia?
I met her after she'd been there for 2 years.
Oh, I see. So she was quite recent, comparatively speaking. So whereabouts did she come from in England?
She came from Stevenage, you know.
All right, yeah.
But she lived in Spain for a while. You know, like, her father was an American. She was actually born in America. And she's had an American passport, and she came here, so she's had nothing but problems with it. But, you know, Jane belongs to, you know, I don't know if you've ever read the book The Ginger Man, written by J.P. Dunleavy. Well, the actual main character in his book was Jane's father. You know, a chap called Sebastian Dangerfield. And, you know, he was friends with Dunleavy and Brendan Bean and whatnot. You know, they all went to Trinity College in Dublin. Jane's mother, her father.
What did he do, Jane's father?
He was studying to be a lawyer with an Irish-American community. And he met Jane's mother at Trinity College, and they got married, and she got pregnant. She went to America and had Jane there. And then Don Levy wrote the book about... I mean, he dropped out of college. Sebastian... In fact, Don Levy had just rewritten the book, and it's called The History of the Ginger Man. And he's named the people in real life.
Oh, really?
Because most of the characters are dead now.
All right.
And so it was interesting.
Right. So you decided to leave because it was...
You know, it was a number of things. You know, to be honest with you, I was growing tired of Africa and African-related problems. And the other thing is I was scared of my children growing up under an apartheid system. And that, you know, I heard my daughter using the word Kaffir once, which I've never used, see? And I said, you know...
So I'll, what age was she when she did that? Roughly.
Seven, I think.
Seven, yeah.
And, you know, no. Seven. She'd be about ten.
All right, yeah.
And I said, you know, I want them to make up their own mind about life. You know, I don't want them to... there was a number of things. And the other thing was I didn't see a future for myself in Africa. I said, you know, if I'm going to leave, I've got to leave now, you know, because if I come back, they're going to put me in a scrap heap. Can you see that? And I felt myself...
So if you left it longer, you'll wind up in a bad position in England.
Yeah.
So what happened... So just tell me, so how do you wrap things up, or...?
I packed up with a company, and everything fell into place. Jane came back to England, and I got called into the company one day, and the company was expanding, and... there was a chap who formed an electronics division, and this chap, I was forever servicing his machines for him, you know, and I wasn't too pleased with it because, you know, he'd blame the guards, he'd blame anything except his machines. It was in its infancy, a system called the Kivalert. I was called into the office one day. Now, about the year before, I'd had an argument, a dispute with the marketing director who was living with the boss. And she actually took me down in front of my subordinates, you know, started really ripping into me. So I waited till after it was finished.
But the boss was presumably the chap that the ex-SADF officer who asked you out. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, she could manipulate him quite a bit. And she called me into the office one day. And, of course, she was one of these people. She always seemed to be taking... dynamic action. You know, she was always reading books on, you know, how to win friends and influence people. You know, these Dale Carnegie books and...
Improve your management.
Yeah, right. So she calls us all in and she started on us, you know, and...
On you? She called you in?
No, called me in with the junior managers.
Right, yeah.
And she just started ripping into him in front of them. And this chap was, in actual fact, he was taking the onus off the Kivalert, his system. And he said... She said there should be two dogs at such and such a place. I think it was Pretoria Racecourse. I said, yes, that's correct. Why was there only one there? I said, it's very simple, because the dogs are not being released from the training school. Couldn't you have taken a dog off another position? I said, no, because that is the only position that has two dogs. And she really started harping on. I said, Yvonne, before you go any further, I said, do you recall a conversation I had with you last year? Reference, you know, telling me off in front of my subordinates. No, I don't. I said, well, let me enlighten you on it. I said, if you ever talk to me like that again, I was going to come right back in the spot. And I said, you know, I said, take your job and shove it. That was my exact words. And this director type chap went to stand up. I said, I think you better stay seated. And it was like, everything was coming together. I said the sort of thing I wanted to say because I'd seen men in the company. I mean, they used to use people. To me, I called it the paper handkerchief syndrome. You blow your nose in it, you no longer need it anymore, you throw it in the dustbin.
Right.
And I felt people in the company were being used. Like, I was terribly high turnover of staff, which is a reflection on the leadership of the company. Right. And I went straight there, backed up my desk, went to see an officer who I worked with, Mark Adams, and we went up to a place called the Palms Hotel. Very, very colonial, you know, the bar all done in copper, you know, that beaten copper.
Mark Adams was...
He was my ex-OC from the army.
Was he the one who was in charge of the company?
No,
different chap.
He was one of the directors who I got on extremely well with.
Right.
And he was getting it hard as well. So we sat there, and the next thing, a sort of emissary comes round for the company. You've got 4 days to apologise, think about your actions, you know.
Aye.
And I said, no. And it was over. You know, it was, I'd enjoyed working there, but, you know, it was getting to a stage where I wasn't enjoying it.
Mm.
So, you know, I wanted to leave on a high note, and feeling good about what I'd done instead of walking out the door with my head in between my legs after, you know, having upset somebody and losing my job. So, you know, I feel I left at the right time.
And so your wife, what, packed up with the hospital, did she? Or?
Yeah, she came back to the UK and...
You all left?
No, she left before me.
Oh.
Aye.
How did that work? I mean, just...
Well, I'll tell you what happened is the decision for her to go home, I was going to stay for another year. The decision for her to go home was made when my daughter was born. I mean, I was in a wheelchair, and I'm one of the branch managers had folded up, and the pressure got too much for him, and he just cracked, and they left. So I went through to run the Johannesburg branch and run the area from another branch. And I was actually sleeping in the branch. I mean, the things were actually, the wheels were coming off.
Right. So she went back to the UK.
Yeah.
What? How long before you went?
About 2 months.
2 months.
Aye.
Threw in the job. Where'd she gone back to in England?
She came back to Birmingham.
How come? Family?
Because I had a friend there, John Carey. We had nowhere to live.
Uh-huh.
And John Carey says, listen, my house is empty.
Mm.
I'm in the process of letting it. Mm. She says, take it.
Right.
And he actually, we get straight into his house and Jane gets sorted out.
Mm.
And as I say, I came back off. My intention was to stay longer, you know.
Right. And then you decided to leave SA.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you came back to England as well.
Yeah.
To Birmingham.
Yes.
Yeah. Then what? So what happened after that?
It was horrendous because Jane thought she could come back nursing again. And they wanted her papers to prove she was a nurse. So she had to get her papers from South Africa and get her papers from Rhodesia, you know, her qualifications. So she wrote
She qualified overseas.
Yeah, she did.
Yes.
So she...
But not in England.
Not in England.
Right.
So she got her papers from South Africa and they says, now we want your papers from Rhodesia. She wrote to the Andrew Fleming Hospital and they changed its name to an African name. So there's all sorts of confusion there. And she eventually got it. She couldn't work, so I arrived back there. I'm out of work.
Mm.
And
were her nursing qualifications acknowledged in England?
Eventually they were, yeah.
Yeah.
But she couldn't work without them being there.
No. How long did that take?
It took about 3 months.
3 months, yeah. So she was at least working after that.
Yeah.
And what happened to you then?
I came back, and as I say, Jane couldn't work at that time because she didn't have her stuff through. And I came back and I thought, well, I'll try and do something, and there was nothing I could do. I mean, I was still limping, and two sort of sticks, you
really?
Know. Yeah. So I went to the Dole.
It
was so horrendous. I mean, I walked into the Dole, Small Heath, and all the instructions for the Dole were sort of written in Farsi, Urdu, you know, all the different languages. And at the bottom, it's got in English, you know, the instructions. And you know, I sat down there, and it was like something like a Rabsy Nesbitt show, you know, the I mean, all I could see was a chap there of Asian extraction, you know, gibbering away in a foreign language. And all I could hear was, you know, it was interspersed by the word gyro, you know. Gyro. I mean, I don't know if I'm doing the right thing here, but I'm telling you, you know, what actually happened. And I just looked, I said to Mummy, I said, I can't do this. I said, Jane, I cannot come down here and put my name. I said, Jane, I'm leaving you. It was a cosmetic thing, you know. And I wasn't showing my responsibility. If she walked in there and threw herself at her mercy, my husband's left me, they looked after her. While I was there, they didn't believe that I had no money. And what they didn't realise, I had to sell up my home to get the fares back. Can you see that? Mm. So, Jane and I then split up. And I went to Hereford and was trying to get one of these jobs with one of the big companies. And eventually I got sorted out.
Right.
Now, I'd left Africa and I said, I'll never go back there again.
Oh, yes, yes.
And I finished up with a job back in Africa for a year.
For a year, and that was doing?
Yeah. It was, I was doing part of a armed response team for the EEC personnel in Kampala, in Uganda.
Mm-hmm. Who were you actually working for?
I was working for a company called Saladin. Not Saladin, sorry, KMS.
Keeney Meaney Services.
Yeah, I worked for them, yeah.
And they're based in...
They were based in Kensington.
Kensington. Mm. And, is Bruce somebody or other is in charge?
I couldn't tell who was in charge.
So you're working for them, and they're all ex-SAS or whatever.
Yeah.
And so how many of them were there in Uganda?
Can I tell you this little build-up? The thing was, is I had applied for a job, and the next thing says, can you go now? And I was in much the same state as yeah. I was grossly overweight, and the other thing, my legs were bad. So yeah. I go to this company, and there's a young dashing officer picks me up at the door. Let's go up the stairs, but he's sort of taking the steps about three at a time. You know, by the time I get to the top, I'm breathing really heavy, and I'm going, you know, trying to show that I'm not breathing heavy. Yeah. And I made an excuse. I said, I've got a toilet here to catch my breath, and you know, my legs were actually throbbing with the pain of climbing the stairs. So I'm holding my sort of stomach in, you know, and looking at the partner, she's right, and he gave me a briefing. Anyway, I got to Uganda. I got through that part of it. I got to Uganda and I stepped off, and there was a chap who had known from the squadron.
All right.
And he said to me, Peter, if I hadn't known you in that state, I'd have said, don't come out. And it clicked with me, you know. I said, okay. So I started training, and I lost about 3.5 stone in 5 months, yeah.
Yeah.
And I knocked some, like, 6.5-7 inches off my waistline.
Right.
I really took it serious, and when I came home, I hadn't touched a drink, nothing. I was like a pit bull when I came back from there.
Yeah. And that was. So what did you actually have to do when you were out there?
Well, what we did was you did one day a week protecting the office. So there was four of us. So 1 week you did 1 week out of four, you did 2 days in the office, and the rest of it was 1 day. And then you'd patrol the houses at night time.
Mm.
And if the for example, if the delegate went anywhere, one of us was always with them.
As a bodyguard. What was the threat?
It was basically lawlessness, you know, among the Ugandan army. You know, they'd break into the houses and...
Who was in charge then? It was Hastings? Museveni.
Just after Milton Obote.
Milton Obote.
You had Akello took over, and then Museveni took over from him.
Yeah. And so what was the situation there? The shooting every night in the tower?
Oh, you could hear, you know, firefights going on, you know, the odd burst of tracer going over the top. But generally speaking, that's what you get in African armies anyway. You know, the discipline had broke down. And, I mean... You know, from what I knew of the Ugandan army and the King's African Rifles, there was a good solid base there. But, I mean, you can't expand. If you take Uganda before independence, with 1,800 troops and 4,000 police, the country was you know, functioned.
Mm.
But with an army of 40,000 that was under Museveni, I mean, law and order just, in a lot of cases, it was non-existent. Mm.
Yeah. Mm. So what were you armed with?
We had the MP-12 Beretta submachine guns, and Browning hyper pistols.
Right. Did you have any incidents?
No.
It's a calm time.
You know, like things, we never. There's been some shooting before I got there, but it was only one incident.
Right.
It's mainly harassment you get with soldiers on roadblocks and whatnot.
Mm. And how did you have to deal with that?
There was one guy there. You know, you smooth your way through it and just say yeah. But there was one chap really gave us a hard time, and we. Got there. I mean, he was drunk. You could smell the drink off him. You know, and he was carrying an AK rifle. I just says, give him everything he wants. Give him everything he wants.
Money-wise.
Aye. So we got the delegate guy through, took him up to a project, and then I immediately got the Land Rover. Another guy came down and got a hold of this guy. But this time he was asleep. Mm. Just took his rifle away. You know, took him into the Communist Party headquarters and explained the situation, and they weren't so nice to him. Can you see that?
Well, you got the money back off him.
Oh yeah. But, you know, I looked at the chap. I said, do you think the same as me? He says, yeah. I said, let's go back.
Oh, yeah. Wallop, yeah.
You know, it's the way it was there. I mean, yeah.
So, was that well paid?
It was an extremely well paid job.
Right. Okay. And so you finished that, and by the time you finished that, you're back in
UK.
Good fitness.
Oh yeah, I came back from there, and then I finished a 1 year contract, and I was at a loose end. You know, so I'm saying, you know, what am I going to do? And someone else had taken my place at the job, you know, and I was. And these jobs, you've got to be on the spot when they come. They don't look for them. Whoever's there will get the job. Can you see
available?
That?
Yeah. Aye. If you're available, that's it.
So, I was there one day, and I was sitting in the pub in Hereford, and I said, well, what am I going to do? You know, I was phoning around in normal routine trying to get jobs.
How long have you been back?
This was two months.
Right. And your wife's still in Birmingham?
No. Jane, while I was in the...
Uganda.
Jane had moved up to Lincoln.
All right.
So what happened is...
You got relatives or family?
No, she moved there. She had a job in the hospital there.
All right, yeah.
And we bought a house in Lincoln.
Right.
And so what happened, I'd come back down to Hereford to look for work again. Mm. Because that's where all the contacts were.
Sure.
And I sat in the pub there. And lo and behold, a man from my past walked in, a chap called Dave Tompkins.
Uh-huh.
And he said to me, what are you doing? I says, in between jobs at the moment. He says, are you interested in doing a bit of work? So he gave me the outline of a job that was needing done, and I agreed to it.
So this was?
It was to attack a communist house in a place called the Summa Pass in Colombia. And it was called Casa Verde, the house was called Casa Verde. And it's where they had their little sort of, their meetings, their little seat of government in exile, or government within the country, alternative government.
Yeah. So that brings us up to 1988.
No, that's...
Or back end of 77.
87. 88. Now hold on, there's a gap there. What did I do?
After Uganda.
Yeah. Did I go back on the oil rigs? No, I didn't. It was 88, yeah.
All right. Yeah. So, there you were, Colombia.
Yeah.
And so what was the sequence of events then?
I flew out there, and it was really funny. They booked Dave and I into a room, and they said, be on standby, we'll call you any time. You know, this is, we're dealing with sort of, they're an intelligence colonel.
Colombian intelligence colonel.
Yeah. And it was funny because, you know, you get there, and it was like something out of one of these Inspector Clouseau type things. You know, the Colombian looked like, the actual Colombian looked like what people thought a Colombian looked like. You know, the sort of
central,
heavy moustache.
Central casting.
Aye.
What did he have? Big moustache?
Big moustache, sort of baggy suit, you know.
Yeah.
You know, a light, you know, faded colour. And the only thing missing was the hat, but that came later.
Yeah, bright glasses, big nose.
Aye, and so we... Then get there, and it was really funny because they say, don't leave the room. So what happened is, maybe I'd nip out for a couple of minutes, and Dave would nip out for a couple of minutes. And we were in this room the whole time, and we never left. And we'd just got all our meals brought up there. And you could hear the staff laughing. You know, they thought Dave and I were a pair of homosexuals, you know. So eventually, you know, this is when I first became aware of the Manana syndrome, you know. Yeah. Manana, you know. And a knock comes to the door, and we open the door, and there's the Colombian that everybody thinks is the Colombian there. He's got an even baggier suit, but a white hat. You know, one of those white Panama hats. So we sat there, and they started talking about, you know, gave us a brief on the country, you know, what the situation was with the FARC. That was the rebels. Oh. They were operating
on that front.
Liberation of Colombia.
Yeah, okay.
And then there's a number of groups in there, but that's the one we were actually concerned with. And they got on about Summa Pass, right? So we carried on, and I got fairly friendly with this chap, and he'd pop in and see, is everything all right? Do you need any cash? And I'd say, no, we're okay. And chatted away. And then what happened was Dave. No, why did Dave go back? Dave went back to. They were looking for some wireless kit to intercept radio, yeah, radio stuff. And Dave nipped back to get this.
Where, from England?
To England, yeah, to pick it up for them. And the funny thing is, I'd been talking to this chap, and he said, "What is your national dish?" I said, "You know, sort of fish and chips," and I explained fish and chips to him. So I was sitting, and of course, I'm still in this room. I haven't gone out. I'm pure white. The sun outside is beating
How
down.
How long have you been in this room there?
I'm into my third week.
Oh, God.
Right. So next thing, the door opens. He says, "Come with me. Come with me." He's going, fish and chips, you know. So he takes me. I drove about, it must have been 120 kilometres. So we, no, he hadn't, he was seen, I couldn't understand it, but he was trying to say fish and chips. That was it. And we drove down, we finished up in this sort of, we crossed this river, and he pointed out Suma Pass as well. So I says, "Oh, he's doing a recce," because
I couldn't understand.
I said, "He's going, Suma Pass, he's pointing up there." And he's pointing, he's saying, the FARC. So he pulled in this little sort of shanty town, he goes, "Sit down," and he brings it out, and he went, "Fish and chips." You know, and you know, the fish still had the eyes in it, you know. I said, what's going on, you know, and I had to eat it, you know, and pull it away from the... In actual fact, the fish actually looked like one of those Finnan haddock, you know, where they smoke them up in Scotland, the whole fish.
Yeah.
But it still had the sort of eyes in it. And I felt I had to eat it, you know, and, you know, the...
Was it all right once you ate it?
Oh, yeah, well, I mean, it was edible.
Yeah.
There's sort of a taste of sand from it, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway, we drove back and, you know...
So that was the purpose of the excursion?
The excursion. So they then said, "Right, we'll take you in a recce." So they started flying me. First of all, they took me into these military places to pick up maps and photographs and whatnot. And they showed me photographs there, but I couldn't tie in with the maps. So they flew me about 5 times over the Suma Pass. But you know, the whole thing, there was always clouds or something getting in the way, but I could actually get the areas, you know, with the rivers and whatnot.
So what sort of terrain was it there?
It was mountainous. I mean, when I
talk
about it, yeah, jungle, mountain jungle.
And what height was that?
You're talking about 10,000, 12,000 feet.
Really?
Aye. And, you know, I looked at it, and I could actually see the area where the camp was, you know, and I could tie it in with a map then.
And it was on a riverside, was this place?
No. The it was up in the hills,
right.
and there was a track ran from a place called Bonaventura, right up the Suma Pass to the actual place.
Yeah.
And, I mean, from the briefing we had, the government forces knew about this, but they were trying to strike some sort of deal with the FARC, whereas they could settle this thing, you know, they'd bring them into government and whatnot.
Right.
And
why? But you were hired to go and basically
because
attack the place.
Aye, because there was an element within the army, an intelligence element, said this is not going to work.
Mm.
So what we were going to do was, now, one of these chaps...
Why didn't they want to, the intelligence element want to do it
themselves?
Yeah.
This all comes from when you ever heard of the La Villiensa? There was years of an era of violence in Colombia, where something like 100,000 men died. It was a heavy political scene, and there was, you know, killings off and assassinations. And they had to form a group called the Unattributables, who actually sorted it all out. And this guy, one of his relatives had been involved in the forming of this, and this is where they got the idea from.
Right.
So what they wanted to do was to go up and do this house. Originally, we were just supposed to blow up the house and do the guards, and it was to let them know that the army was prepared to strike at them.
Mm.
Whereas, no matter what goes on in Colombia, everything gets leaked out. Everything. You know, the army, they cannot mount an op.
Mm.
It's hard to do anything in secrecy because, you know, between the communists and the drugs bands, everything's open season.
So that's why you were hired?
Yeah.
Right. And so you did this aerial recce. What happened after that then?
Right.
And then Dave come back by now?
No, Dave stayed where he was.
Right.
And I looked at it and I said, right, I actually got the area of Suma Pass we were after. And I said, you know, I worked on it. I said, you know what, they outside 12 men to do this. You know, myself and Dave plus 10.
Ten other Brits or whatever.
Yeah. And I put the plan to them. You know, I made little models and whatnot of the area, and the guy seemed extremely happy with it. And they then asked me to go and recruit the people.
Mm.
So
back in England.
I then came back to England, and so you're not supposed to recruit people, and you know all you can do is make it known that there's work available and let the person recruit himself.
Mm.
So I picked up some guys from here who had been in my company,
mm.
and I got some from South Africa.
Mm.
And you know, I just says, you know, there's work going, and
mm-hmm.
you know, so we got on with it from there.
Mm-hmm. And so, you all came back to Colombia.
Yes.
And what did you do? Did you have any training sessions or
yeah, what happened
dry
was,
runs?
Or? Right. What happened then was, and this is where the story starts to get, the, you know, a bit of intrigue comes into it. We then went to him and said, look, you know, we've got to train, we've got to shake down for this job. You can't just, this is, we're not Arnold Schwarzenegger, you know.
Mm.
You don't come off a helicopter and go straight in the jungle. You know, we've got to do a shakedown. So we started training, stuck us up in this place called Fantasy Island. And
it's really called Fantasy Island.
Yeah, Isla de la Fantasia, you know. So
what was that, in a river or a lake? Or
it was in the...
sea? Or?
What's that big river that comes down the...
I don't know. The only one I can think of would be the Orinoco, but I'd probably be wrong.
No, it's the...
Well, anyway.